Hi, I'm Monica Packer, and you're listening to About Progress, where we are about progress made practical. For those of you who have been in a long-standing couple relationship, when did you first notice that you felt a little differently about your significant other than when you were first together? I don't mean this necessarily in a bad way, but you feel more like your family instead of romantic partners. I remember one of my old roommates got married a while before we did, and she said something about that, how being married for a while made her feel like she and her husband were family. Their love had changed, and not for the bad, but for different, for deeper, and ultimately, for better. The thing about long-standing coupledom is that alongside a shifting love relationship, you also will absolutely experience shifts in your sexual relationship too. Now, I personally want to have a very happy and long marriage on every level, and I know I'm not alone in that. And that's why I was so thrilled to invite a returning podcast guest to the show, Emily Nagoski. She's here to discuss her latest book on creating long-standing sexual connections. It's called Come Together, and I see it as the next step and expansion on her prior two books, Come As You Are and Burnout. In this interview, Emily and I will discuss the common myths we're all conditioned to carry around long-term committed relationships, the truth about those myths, and how we can, against all the odds thrown at us, learn to come back together to each other every time. Emily Nagoski, PhD, is the award-winning author of the New York Times bestseller Come As You Are and co-author with her sister Amelia of Burnout and now Come Together, the science and art of creating lasting sexual connections. Emily began her work as a sex educator at the University of Delaware and went on to earn a master's in counseling and a PhD in health behavior. Now she combines sex education and stress education to teach women to live with confidence and joy inside their bodies. Emily lives in New England with one strange cat, two rescue pups, and a cartoonist. A quick disclaimer, while not explicit, we will be discussing sex in this episode, so be sure to have your earbuds in if you have little ones around. First, a quick break from our sponsors. I planted tulip bulbs for my first time ever last fall, and I have been so delightfully surprised to see that they are poking out of the ground, and pretty soon the flowers are going to come out, and it's making me feel like it is spring. And when spring rolls around, there's always things that I am recommitting to, from deep cleaning and organizing my home to doing some interior design projects, preparing for our garden, which is my second year only. But I also reprioritize my do something list. If you haven't made much progress in yours, and if that even includes not making one, you are in good company. Here at About Progress, we believe it is never too late, and that includes it's never too late to make your do something list or recommit. To help you with either of those, I would encourage you to take my Do Something List training. It has a free video workshop as well as a workbook and tons of examples from real progressors from our community and the DSLs they've created for this year. Join me in recommitting to you via your DSL. You can find our free training at aboutprogress.com/DSL. Emily Nagoski, welcome to About Progress.
I'm so excited to talk to you again.
Oh, well, the honor is mine. I mean, I have just been buzzed for weeks and looking forward to this. You are a sexpert.
Sexpert?
Yes, you're a sexpert. And I learned so much from your first book, Come As You Are, as well as Burnout with your sister, Amelia Nagoski, who we've also been lucky enough to have on the show. But this is, I feel like, a continuation of everything I've learned from you so far and an expansion. So I think it's so fun to know the story, though, behind this, because I've heard you share it on your podcast and then in your book. It was fun to read it there, too. That even as an expert, there was a time where you found it really difficult to practice what you preach in your own committed long-term relationship. So can you start by telling us about that?
Yeah, I'm so glad you experienced it as an expansion and deepening of my work so far, because that is the story of how this book came to be. You might think that the process of writing and talking and thinking and reading about sex all the time could be super sexy, but it turns out No, the process of writing Come As You Are was so stressful that I lost all interest in actually having any sex. Finished the book, things got a little better. I went on book tour, things got a lot worse. And I tried to follow my own advice from Come As You Are, responsive desire. You know, you put your body in the bed, you let your skin touch your partner's skin, and your body goes, oh, I like this person. I like this. What a good idea this was. And instead, I would put my body in the bed, let my skin touch my partner's skin, and I would cry and fall asleep. And I thought, oh, I need more advice than I give in my own book. So I did what anyone would do. I went to Google Scholar, and I looked at the research that actually talks to people who have excellent sex lives, asking them how they do it and how they got to have those sex lives, how they sustain a sexual connection across expanses of time. And what I found there contradicted the entire sort of mainstream discourse around sex in long-term relationships. Because, I mean, very much at the time that I was doing this research, there was this conversation that's basically, is intimacy the enemy of the erotic and you need distance to keep the spark alive? Or is intimacy the foundation of the erotic and you need closeness to keep the spark alive? And when you talk to people who have great sex lives, they don't talk about spark. Barely scrapes into the top 10 characteristics of spectacular sex. It's just not part of what makes sex worth having. Instead, they talk about authenticity and vulnerability. They talk about pleasure. Above all, they talk about empathy as being the foundation of really extraordinary sex. So I was reading this and I was like, oh, how come I've never read this in a book?
Yes.
And my agent pointed out that I should probably write it.
Well, that's a good agent. And also you need that kind of person, right? Who's telling you, that's you. That's you. And we need it from you. What are the things that people think this isn't normal? I think all of us think we are exceptions in so many ways. And that was my biggest takeaway from Come As You Are, is that we are all actually normal. Like anything we wonder about, even from how our body looks to how sex may feel, we are all normal.
When things are going in a way we are like, this is like disturbing or distressing, or I'm dissatisfied with what's happening, that's your sexuality functioning normally in a world that is determined to break your sexuality. Like your sexuality is struggling to be its full self in a world that's totally determined to make you dislike everything about your erotic body.
Okay. I mean, mic drop right there. But true. And you're right, though. When we see that picture, we make it less about, oh, something's wrong with me. I'm actually normal and I'm responding to my environment in an actually healthy and wise way.
Yes.
Okay. Well, let's do that with long-term relationships. Okay.
Yes.
Then it's like, what are the things that people think this isn't normal? Or what are some common misconceptions they have about long-term sexual relationships that you're like, we need to just stop that. Stop it.
Yeah. Gosh, there's so many things.
Okay.
I did an event with Heather Corinna, who runs Scarlatine, and they talk to like 14-year-olds who've never been in any kind of relationship, never mind a sexual relationship. And these children already have this idea in their head that when they get into a relationship that becomes long-term, it's going to be like hot and heavy, horny, can't wait to do things
fireworks
at the beginning. And that's gradually going to fade over time. And either you just have to accept that like it's never going to be a part of your life again, or you like invest time and energy and money to like spice things up and keep the spark alive. And nothing about that narrative is factually correct.
Okay.
It can be true. And especially if you believe it, you can make it true. But what's actually happening for the couples who sustain a sexual connection over the long term, instead of thinking about desire, think about pleasure. There's this wonderful analogy I learned from a sex therapist in New Jersey named Christine Hyde. She talks to her clients and says, imagine your best friend invites you to a party. You say yes because it's your best friend and it's a party. But as that date starts approaching, you're going, there's going to be traffic on a Friday night. I'm going to have to find childcare. Am I going to want to put my party clothes on? at the end of a long week. But you said you'd go. So you trim your nose and ear hair, you put on the body glitter, and you show up to the party. And then what happens? A lot of the time, you have fun at the party. If you are having fun at the party, you are doing it right. The couples who sustain a strong sexual connection love to throw parties. It's like a hobby that they share. Is the co-creation of context that make it easy for their brains to get to an erotic, pleasurable place.
Basically, you're saying they prioritize sex and they prioritize pleasure. Does that also mean they like make the space and time for it? Like literally on the calendar? I'm sure that's different for each calendar.
Sometimes literally on the calendar. Scheduling is not for everyone. Some people have like a demand avoidance resistance. It's actually called the ironic process, where the more you insist, you try to do something, the more your brain's like, no, can I do it? So scheduling doesn't work for everyone, but there's three characteristics of these couples who sustain a strong sexual connection that lasts. One, they are friends.
Yeah.
They admire and like each other. I hope it's not controversial that liking the person that you like touch your whole skin against is good.
Yeah.
So if the relationship has to be basically you have to like each other.
Mm.
Two, they do prioritize sex. The trick with prioritizing sex means that you have to be willing to deprioritize something else. What are you willing to not do in order to create the time and the energy to close the door on the rest of your life and just do this, let's face it, pretty silly thing that we humans do? What is it about sex that's more valuable as a way to spend your time than watching reruns of Parks and Recreation? It's an actual question.
Yes, that's a good question.
The couples who sustain a strong sexual connection prioritize sex. They decide that it really contributes something important to their relationship that they sustain this connection. That doesn't mean that sex never falls off the priority list, because life happens.
Yeah.
But because they have decided that it matters, they're motivated to find their way back to each other. And then the third characteristic of couples who sustain these strong sexual connections is, this is the hard one, they recognize that they've been following somebody else's rules for how they're supposed to do a sexual connection, and they decide they're not going to do that anymore. They're going to be their authentic sexual selves. They're going to receive their partner as their authentic self, and they're going to co-create a sexual connection that is right for them specifically, without reference to what anybody else says their relationship is supposed to be like.
I feel like a lot of us don't even think about that. Just how much maybe the movies we watch or the marriages that were modeled to us, or even the way our friends are navigating their sexual relationships, how that actually impacts the way we think it's supposed to look like.
Yeah.
And that can be freeing.
You know, we were talking about myths and center, I call it the desire imperative, this idea that like, if you don't have spontaneous desire for sex, then you don't have anything worth having. When actually what matters is pleasure. Do you like the sex you are having? Did you know that people believe you more when what you say rhymes?
Oh.
They remember it better,
but
and they believe you more.
I'm bad at
that. I made a rhyme.
I know you're good at it. So yeah, let's hear it.
Pleasure is the measure.
Yeah.
Pleasure is the measure of sexual well-being. It is not about how often you do it. It is not about how often you do it. Because even I, still, my brain goes to the place of how long has it been since we did the thing, and I start to beat myself up if it's been too long. It's truly not about how often, it's not about how many orgasms you have, even it's whether or not you like the sex you are having. Wouldn't it be better to have sex at a frequency that feels comparatively infrequent to you, whatever that is, and everyone involved really enjoys it, versus having sex at a frequency that feels very frequent to you, and at least one person involved doesn't enjoy it? It's really not about frequency. It's about whether or not you like it. Pleasure is the measure. But the other myth I just want to get rid of entirely is the idea that if you have to talk about it, there must be something wrong.
Okay.
Couples who sustain a strong sexual connection talk about sex all the time. because it's like a shared hobby. If you're into community theater, you don't just talk about it when you're at rehearsal or like at the show. You talk about it in between. You talk about it on the drive to rehearsal. You talk about it while you're making dinner. If you're really into like cooking, you don't just talk about it while you're eating the dinner. You talk about it when you're making the grocery list, and you talk about what went great with this recipe last time and what you want to change next time, right? I use the language of like, it's a third thing. There's you and your partner, and you turn your shared gaze toward this shared project. So when people have kids, your kids are a third thing. You turn your joint gaze onto this project that you share together. It is a site of joint fascination. Your sex life deserves to be a third thing like that, where you talk about it all the time because it's an important thing that you share. It's an important part of your life.
Oh my goodness.
Couples who talk about it all the time have better sex.
And it's so funny that that's, you know, part of your third point there. We think we shouldn't be talking about it, or like we shouldn't have to. That's probably more the real thing. Like, we shouldn't have to. It should just
We feel like we
happen.
Shouldn't have to. It should just be easy and spontaneous. It should be natural.
Mm-hmm.
Look, I'm busy. Aren't you busy?
Yeah.
Almost nothing in my life happens that's not in my calendar. So I've often heard people say, if my partner has to schedule it, they don't want me enough.
Mm-hmm.
Look, like, because we're busy, if connecting with me erotically is so important to my partner that they block out time on their calendar for it, they're like, I don't care what else is going on. These 2 hours are for us.
Mm-hmm.
Like, that is pretty freaking sexy.
You know, and why don't we just say it that way? I mean, that's not only a better reframe, it feels like a more honest reframe. It feels real. And that's where, I mean, I think I want to talk about another myth, too, that you've brought up in your book as well. But I mean, we covered so many great ones. But I think the myth of it, there's something wrong with us if our sexual connection, whether it's connected to our sexual desire or the frequency or even the level of pleasure, if it ebbs and flows, something is wrong with us.
Right.
So let's talk about that.
Yeah, of course it ebbs and flows. Because our lives change. So the mechanism in your brain that controls sexual response is called the dual control mechanism. Very briefly, it means you've got a sexual accelerator that notices sexy information in the environment and sends the turn on signal. And you've got brakes that notice all the good reasons not to be turned on right now, all the potential threats in the environment. And our lives throw a lot of stuff at our brakes. The context is made of both your external circumstances and your internal state. So some of the things that hit the brakes are your external circumstances, like the amount of time you have available, the amount of worry about money, the kids, just like your all the life stuff that has nothing to do with sexuality itself. And then there's your internal state, which is the state of mind that you're in. And there's only two ideas in the book that require two chapters to explain. An internal state is one of them. There's a whole metaphor of the emotional floor plan. But basically, our lives are such that we spend a lot of time stressed out in a fear state of anxiety and worry, or in a rage state of frustration and irritation.
Yeah.
And those two states are 1,000 miles away from the states of mind where our brain can experience pleasure. So if you're in that, like, so for example, when I was crying and falling asleep with my husband, my brain was in the fear state. I was so worried. I was so stressed out from like, am I doing this right? Am I doing this well enough? Is this working at my job, with my work, with the book?
Mm.
But I would get skin to skin with my partner. And, you know, I wrote a whole book about stress management. I should have recognized it at the time. One of the best, most evidence-based ways to complete the stress response cycle and get myself out of the fear space is connection.
Mm-hmm.
So my body would come in contact with like my favorite person alive on earth and go, oh, I'm safe now. I can let this go. And that my crying was
Got
my
it.
Brain being like, oh, I can relax now.
I'm safe.
I can allow my body to release. I am safe enough now that I can calm down this stress response that I've been in the middle of for so long. And okay, so I get out of the stress space. Where am I now? I'm so physically exhausted that I literally just need like sleep and a snack and probably a bath, right? And only then do I have the wherewithal to get myself into a brain state where I can actually experience pleasure. So there's like at least three steps between me and a sexy state of mind.
Let's take a quick break for our sponsors. Hopefully you heard that I have transitioned my self-paced course, The Sticky Habit Method, into now a live version of the course. That means I teach the lessons live. And in addition to that, we have weekly coaching calls that go with the lessons too, all in a 21-day intensive. And it's called The Sticky Habit Intensive. We finished our first round back at the end of February, and it was so astonishing how much the women learned and changed, even for me. I wanted to share one woman's experience in general. This is her whole review of the Sticky Habit Intensive. She said, "I prefer to learn and study on my own, and the idea of a live class with video made me uncomfortable and nervous. This was my first time taking a live online course, and I was so surprised by how much I engaged with the community and enjoyed it. This is a great way to relearn habit formation. Monica is a fantastic teacher and so supportive toward everyone. It felt comforting rather than scary to share the struggles we individually have, both with her and the other participants. I will reap the benefits of what I learned in this course far into the future. It was definitely worth my time, effort, and money. I looked forward to all of the calls and listening to the other women share their stories, and I was and still am inspired to relearn habit formation." I really love this woman's experience, and she was not unique. I want you to not be unique either. Join us in learning how to form sustainable habits, even with less time, low energy, and limited support, because that is who this intensive is designed for. Our next Sticky Habit Intensive is going to be coming up soon, just in time for you to gain some habits that will help you move throughout the spring and summer. To get on the wait list and be the first in the know, also first dibs to our spots that will now be capped for each of these intensives, go to aboutprogress.com/intensive. Again, get on the wait list to reserve your spot before the doors open to the public. That's aboutprogress.com/intensive. So for women who are listening to this and like, boy, do I relate to the, I just need to sleep, I need a snack, and I need to take a bath. But they're on that train perpetually. And it sounds like you were for a long time.
Yeah.
That, what you just said can be both hopeful and not depressing, but also like, oh, crap. So like,
well, it's knowing what's true thing. Like, yeah. It's a recognition of what's actually going on in your brain. Why does it feel so hard? This is why it feels hard, because it is. It feels hard because it's, I know we all got taught that pleasure and sex is supposed to be easy and obvious and natural and spontaneous. We got lied to for decades. And when I explain what's actually true, you're like, that sounds so much harder than I ever thought it was supposed to be. But the good news is that it actually works. Like, this is how you actually find your way to a sexy state of mind, is by figuring out how to get to a space where your brain can experience pleasure.
Okay.
And hey, listen, when you get more practice at transitioning out of these pleasure adverse spaces, the fear space and the anger space, and also the panic grief space, which is where I experience isolation and feeling trapped and lonely. That's where shame lives. When we practice transitioning out of those spaces into the pleasure favorable spaces, that means we are practicing transitioning out into the difficult spaces into the pleasurable spaces.
Okay.
And that is going to mean our lives are more pleasurable overall, not just that we have more and better sex, but that we are better able to savor all of the pleasures of our lives.
It's funny how so much of what you have to teach us doesn't have to do with like anything mechanical.
Shh. I'm just teaching you how to have a better sex life.
Yeah.
This isn't about like making your life better. It's not about changing the world. It's just, I mean, like I could go the like, here's, you know, 6 tips for giving a great oral sex, whatever. It turns out that's not actually what people need.
Exactly. And that to me is another point again, when you're like, oh, actually, that's really nice to hear. But then what do I do with this? Because It's not just about getting better at technique. It's actually so much bigger and so much more important than I ever realized. And for the women who are kind of in that space, maybe in the perpetual exhaustion state, oh, let's just call it burnout. Read burnout, okay? But if they're in that perpetual state and they're also hearing you, they believe you. In many ways, like, I am ready now. Okay, it means I need to take care of all the other states so I can move into more of that sexy state of mind. What advice do you have for them? Where do they start and what can they expect on this path?
In the context of a long-term relationship?
Yes.
Get more help from your partner. If you are burnt out like that, get more help first from your partner, because we're assuming that there is a partner. And if that partner would like you to be connecting sexually with them in a more profound way than you are currently, one of the most like sex positive things they can do for your relationship is listen to what you need in order not to be so stressed and overwhelmed.
Yeah.
And just like get that stuff off your plate.
Mm-hmm.
If it means hiring somebody to clean the house, like figure out how to make that affordable. If it means that they are the one who does all the stuff in the morning because you just are a night owl and your brain is not very functional in the morning, like let them take over for multiple days a week to do the morning stuff. Like get the help you need so that your body can be adequately rested. And let's also normalize that there are times when it's not going to be there. Like for me, there just were times when it was not there, mm-hmm. and that's okay. Does it matter enough for you to put sex ahead of anything else that is currently taking up your time and energy? What are you willing to not do so that you have time and space for pleasure? And I would love for people to have conversations. Like, if you do only one thing as a result of listening to this, have a conversation with your partner. I really love questions like, what is it that I want when I want sex? People will flippantly say orgasm, but actually it turns out it's things like connection and shared pleasure and feeling or being wanted and having the freedom to just like escape into pleasure. And what is it that I don't want when I don't want sex? I don't want to feel obliged to do something that I'm not into. I don't want to feel the shame that I was taught I was supposed to feel about it. These like big things that people don't want when they don't want sex. Have that conversation just as a starting point with your partner so that you're bypassing the like, but why won't you have sex with me? So that no one is like blamed, no one is shamed, no one is like broken. Yeah. There's nothing wrong with each person. There's nothing wrong with the relationship. You're just trying to solve this puzzle.
I always love learning from people who are curious to learn more and to be surprised by what they're learning about, even if it's something that it's already a field that they're really well known for and they are really into and doing a good job. And that's what you've done with this book. And you start by sharing, like, you know, even in the introduction, you shared those three premises you shared about what, you know, these long-lasting sexual connections have in common.
Yeah, that's literally just the introduction. Here you go.
Yes, which I love that you did that. But also, I love that you were surprised so much. And so I've been curious about one or maybe two things that surprised you the most as you were researching and learning from people who have been doing this for quite some time, just in their own lives.
Yeah. Honestly, the biggest sort of like transformational moment for me wasn't about the research. It was about stuff that happened in my personal life. Okay. 2 weeks before the book was due, a friend of mine died of cancer. Her name was Anna. She was a librarian. She was right around my age, mid-40s. And she and her wife got married just a few months after my husband and I got married. And they had already reached their till death do us part. And here I was writing this book about sex and long-term relationships. And so what does long-term even mean? And like, I was writing sections about like disability and interabled couples because I recognized that body changes happen, especially over time. But I was really confronted with the reality that we are not guaranteed extended time with the people we choose to spend our lives with. We are only promised change. And it's really how we navigate those changes together that characterizes the quality of our relationship. So the whole second half of the book shifted to be about navigating change in a way where every day that you spend with your partner, even if it's still a day when you don't have sex, is a day that you turn toward each other with kindness and compassion and patience and, if at all possible, a sense of play. Because we get today, and even if I spend it still like not having access to sexual pleasure today because my body just doesn't have it, it's a day when we can laugh about that and be kind and affectionate toward each other regardless. Like, we are still each other's best friends, even in a moment of conflict and struggle. Does that make sense?
Oh, absolutely. I think it changes so much about what sex is supposed to really be about. You know, we've talked so much about the myths of long-term sexual relationships, but that to me is the truth. It's about coming together. It's looking to each other, because you're right. I mean, change is constant. Constant.
Yeah.
Even down to like the way our bodies look. And I'm sure, you know, as we go through hormone shifts as women too.
Oh yeah. I wrote this book through perimenopause.
Yes. Which I'm just starting and not
enjoying. It's delightful. It's not. It's chaos. Yeah. So here's the thing. If you're wondering, did writing come together do the same thing to your sex life that writing come as you are did? Yes. Yes, it absolutely did. And I did it with perimenopause, which is a project.
Whole other,
thing. And long COVID.
Oh, I'm so sorry.
And when I got to the end of writing this book, I now had this like 100,000 word tome of how to find my way back to the sexual connection that had been destroyed by writing this book.
Yeah.
And even with perimenopause and long COVID, things are better now than they have been in all our 13 years together, because I like have a manual for I will never again not be able to find my way back. Because I want the book to help so many people. I believe that it can. But if it only ever helps me as much as it has helped me in my relationship, then it was absolutely worth the project, the 3.5 years that it took me to write it.
And this all goes back to that first myth you brought up. You know, those 14-year-olds who think that the beginning of a long-term relationship is all fireworks, and then those fireworks fade, and then you have to try to find the spark for like the remaining how many decades or not that you have together. That's not true either. It can get better, especially as you learn how to find your way back to each other and evolve together.
The more you reject other people's ideas about how you're supposed to be doing this and just turn toward like, what do I like to do? What experiences feel pleasurable? What do I want to try with this person whom I trust? And because I trust this person, we can go to all kinds of curious, interesting places that I've wanted to explore, or it is only occurring to me now to try. I didn't even realize how much I was following somebody else's rules about like what my body is supposed to look like and how it's supposed to behave and what sort of stimulation is supposed to be pleasurable to me. As long as everybody's glad to be there and free to leave, truly, you can do anything that feels good.
This is actually, I think, my final big question. And then we always end with like a practical takeaway. Why does this matter anyway? Like, if this is such a strange thing that we do as humans, and it can be so, like, such a roller coaster ride, especially if you are trying to pursue a decades kind of relationship, why does it matter?
You know what? It doesn't have to matter. There are couples for whom it does not matter. And a lot of couples at least go through phases where it does not matter. And that's okay. Nothing bad happens to our bodies if we don't have access to sex. There is no disease process associated. There's no pain or tissue damage caused by not having sex. And sex is one, it is just one of many, but it is a powerful one of the ways that humans access deep connection with each other, emotional connection, physical connection, spiritual connection. It is one of the ways that we can connect with the most important people, these partners whom we've chosen to be in our lives. I mean, the whole last chapter is about ecstasy. And it's like an instruction manual on how to access a kind of erotic pleasure that makes the universe turn into rainbows. And that is not, like, no one is required to do any of the things in the book. This is all optional. But if you're interested in trying the project of sharing erotic ecstasy, it is really good for us as individuals and in a relationship and for the world as a whole. If our brains know how to access that kind of expansive pleasure where the boundaries of yourself dissolve into your partner and the boundaries of you as a couple dissolve into the universe and you feel part of one giant self that is the entire universe. And people have talked to me about when they live with chronic pain, it is the moment that they are free of pain and the limitations of their bodies. It is a way that people access the divine. Sex can be nothing at all in your life, and it can be just fun and a delight, and it can be a profound and life-changing experience that you share with one of your favorite people on earth.
Love that. So if they liked what they've heard today, then they're going to love your book, Come Together. I'll just hold that up. Love the cover of this, by the way. What?
I'll just say that the reason the subtitle is The Science and Art of Creating Lasting yes. Sexual Connections is because my husband went to art school.
Oh, yeah.
And he drew the illustrations in the book.
Oh, my gosh. Why did I miss that? Like, I don't know how I missed that.
I mean, the only place it's acknowledged is in, like, the copyright page and in the acknowledgments.
Oh, okay. Well, that probably explains it, but good job. Good job, Richard. That's amazing. Okay, well, I love that you have that piece there. So before we leave, I want them to know, like, obviously this is 1% of what's in the book. What is one thing, though, after listening to this conversation, beyond getting the book, which we'll make sure we link to in the show notes and all of that, what is one thing that they can do, like one way they can take action on what you've taught them today?
Have a conversation, or if you can't bring yourself to have a conversation with your certain special someone, have a conversation about the barriers to having the conversation. The two biggest challenges people face when they want to talk about these things, but they just don't know how. They're worried that they're going to say something that their partner will judge. And they're worried they're going to say something that their partner will take personally or will hurt their partner's feelings. So have a conversation about that. These conversations are intended to be an invitation to greater closeness, right?
Okay.
And it can be scary. So talk about like what it would take, like how you could help each other have a conversation that's honest about like building a stronger connection in a way that avoids the potential risk of like hurting each other's feelings, and how are you not going to respond with judgment in case your partner says something that surprises you?
I love even having a conversation about the barriers. I mean, I never thought of that. Like, can we just talk about why we don't talk about this?
Yeah. Why is this so hard?
Mm-hmm. Okay. That's a wonderful way for them to take action. Well, Emily, thank you so much for being on About Progress again. It was a joy to have you.
Thank you so much. It was a delight to be here.
Fantastic. I hope this episode gave you the hug and kick in the pants you need to grow. I'll now share the progress pointers from this episode. These are the notes I took so you don't have to, and those on my newsletter get them in a graphic form each week. You can sign up at aboutprogress.com/newsletter. Number one, having extraordinary sex in a long-term committed relationship is far less about spark and far more about vulnerability, empathy, authenticity, and pleasure. Number two, some myths about sex with long-term relationships include desire is paramount, frequency of sex is most important,
good sex should just happen naturally, and it's not normal to experience ebbs and flows with your sexual connection. Number three, to combat these myths, own these truths. Pleasure is the measure. Happy couples are friends. They prioritize sex. They co-create an authentic sexual relationship together, and they make sex the third thing, so they always come back to it and each other, even with the highs and lows. Number four, if you're struggling to get into a sexy state of mind, validate how life stuff is impacting your sex life. Validate the hard things and figure out how to get your head into a space where you can experience pleasure. And number five, to help with burnout interfering with pleasure, get the help you need. Rest your body. Ask yourself what you're willing to not do to make space for pleasure, and have conversations with your partner about what you want and like about sex. And that leads us to our Do Something Challenge of the Week. Have a conversation about having a conversation with your significant other about building a stronger sexual connection. I really love and admire Emily as well as her sister Amelia. Both of them have been so kind to be on the show. This is now the third interview with the combined two of them. I really hope you check out her book. It has really sparked a lot of understanding for me and some practical ways that I can improve this really important part of my life. This show is listener supported. Supporters of About Progress get access to many, many benefits. There are three levels, starting at just $2 a month. One of the benefits includes my premium podcast, More Personal, where I lean into the personal side of personal development. Soon, we are going to have an honest conversation between my podcast manager, Taylor, and I all about creating, forming, keeping friendships as an adult, what the obstacles are, and what we've been learning about how to be better at making and keeping friends as a grown-up. You can sign up as a supporter at aboutprogress.com/support. And just so you know, you can always support the show for free. It's as simple as texting the link to this episode to a friend you may think is interested in this, or I don't know, even your significant other, so you can have that conversation about a conversation. Thank you so much for listening. Now go and do something with what you learned today. And I love your whole, how did you phrase it? Your Q&A section in the back, like, but Emily, is that how you phrase
it? The but Emily questions. But yes. But Emily, I just want my partner to have more sex with me. How do I get my partner to have more sex with me? But Emily, I just want my partner to stop hassling me for sex. How do I get my partner to stop hassling me for sex? But Emily, what if it really just is my partner? My partner just is the problem. I talk to my partner like you say I should. I say what I want and they react with shock and horror. What then?
Shock and horror. Oh, I hope that's no one who is listening to this right now.